Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and this week's movie gets one star from me because I watched the entire thing and not a single babality. Come on, people. Wow. Joining me today is Devinder Hardwar.
Little retrograde over there, babalities. This movie, hits my Carl Urban rule. Is Carl Urban in it? And it's a great movie.
And Jeff Cannata.
I just have to say, toasty!
Wow, some That's Mortal Kombat very deep cuts. Well, some deep cuts for you guys.
You've practiced that, Jeff.
Yeah, yeah.
I've done it once or twice.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Of course, those are vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we are going to be reviewing Mortal Kombat 2, which is out in theaters right now. It made about as much money in its opening weekend as the first film did in its entire run. Now, granted, that came out in the height of COVID. But
I also think, that was like a 2021 movie. They were aiming for HBO Max, but also they knew what they were doing, holding this off a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I do also want to mention that Devinder Hardwar and I had a chance to speak with the director of Mortal Kombat 2, Simon McCoy, and that episode will be released as the After Dark / bonus episode later on this week. So you can look forward to that. We had a nice chat with Simon McCoy, and huge props to Devinder for setting that one up, but had a great time talking with him, and you can look forward to that conversation again with Simon McCoy, the director of Mortal Kombat 2, later this week as our After Dark. Before we get to what we've been watching and weekly plugs and then our main review, I do want to just acknowledge a couple of emails and comments. Last week on the podcast, we discussed the forthcoming Greta Gerwig film, Narnia, the Magician's Nephew, and we spent a lot of time razzing on that title. You know, razzing on the title, The Magician's Nephew, for a major tentpole blockbuster. Luke S. wrote into our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Regarding The Magician's Nephew title, I think you guys might be slightly outside of the zeitgeist for the target demo on this one. The Narnia books are pretty hard to overstate as an intergenerational, international, decades-long colossal phenomenon that is inextricably tied to both childhood nostalgia and religious/moral values for much of the English-speaking world, and they're good enough that even a lot of people who grew away from Christianity still think of them fondly, particularly for people in my age bracket who managed to hit both the 80s satanic panic and the aughts Harry Potter panic. Narnia was arguably second only to the Bible in terms of universal cultural cachet across Christian pop culture at the time. Even Lord of the Rings was too Catholic for some evangelical American audiences who were very wary of fantasy being demonic in some way. A massive cohort of people experienced Narnia as their first and only fantasy literature. Also, this particular book is wild and has not yet been adapted in the TV series or the movies. Plus, a lot of the modern critique of Narnia is the very 50s anti-feminist messaging that sneaks in and turns things sour. So Gerwig being in charge is very intriguing. Hearing you guys react to that title that was as strange to me as it would be to you hear someone reacting to The Godfather as a hilarious title, end quote. Now, I just want to say, I think it was obvious from the way we talked about it that, like, we are very familiar with the Narnia books. I'm aware of them. Jeff, I assume you've read, right? Like,
We did not explicitly say that in the episode.
We did not explicitly say that. Yes. Still a goofy title.
Yeah, it's an objectively bad title. Yeah. I don't need your context. I don't need anything. It's a bad title.
Yeah.
That's all we're saying.
We can have spent many days of our youth reading Narnia books and understanding that they are universally beloved and that the movie is going to make a ton of money. And also, it's a little bit of a silly title. Like, those are very silly. Those are both things that can be true at the same time.
Yeah. To be fair, I've never read that Narnia book personally. Mm-hmm. Yep. I don't know if you guys have, but
as a kid, that title turned me off. As a kid, I'm like, I don't care about The Magician's Nephew.
It's a goofy title.
I don't care
title.
About this.
It's a, it's a goofy title. Also, I went to Christian school when I was a kid up until fourth grade. Completely absent. I didn't find Narnia until well after that. Mm. Maybe I'm just outside the norm here. I'm not a religious person. Anybody who listens to the show knows that. But if the contention here is that it's part of the sort of, you know, the doctrine of being raised Catholic or Christian in America, I'm an example of not for me. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was not part of like I came to Narnia well after Lord of the Rings, and so I must have been 12 or 13 at least before I ever read a Narnia book. And so I don't know. Maybe for this emailer, that it seemed like, you know, that was part of the soup. Wasn't the soup for me.
It was definitely part of the soup for me. Narnia books, huge part of my childhood. I went to go see a play that was based off of Narnia. That was like a really formative experience for me, being like, oh, I read the book and now I'm seeing the play. That was like one of the first adaptations I ever saw. Didn't see the movie when it came out, but I am definitely going to be seeing Gerwig's version.
Really should have put our bona fides out there. Absolutely. About Narnia.
And I do think, you know, what I advocated for on that episode was that I think this movie is probably going to be a big deal. Whether it's going to be a big of a deal as Barbie, I don't think I can claim that. But
I think Greta Gerwig getting to make anything and having it go to cinemas, that's a great thing. We were agreed. All excited for that. Yeah. The one thing we're saying, that title is silly. I'm sorry if you're too much in the Narnia bubble not to even recognize that reality, but it is very silly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a bet that enough people are in that Narnia bubble, Devendra, that it's going to make a lot of money. So we'll see. Anyway, thank you for the message, Luke. Longtime listener. Appreciate the comment. We also got this email from Ryan writing to /filmcast@gmail.com that I thought was kind of interesting. Ryan writes in, hey, guys, not sure if any of you are interested in Billie Eilish, Hit Me Hard and Soft, the tour live in 3D. But did you know the entire thing is in HFR 3D? If nothing else, I recommend you check it out just for that. It looks phenomenal throughout. Somebody who hates HFR and all previous movies I've seen it on, I think concert films /documentaries make a much more appropriate use case for the tech, end quote. Again, that's Ryan writing into /filmcast@gmail.com. I have heard that watching the Billie Eilish documentary, which is directed by James Cameron.
And Billie Eilish. Co-directed.
Co-directed.
James Cameron, famous control freak, is co-directing a movie with Billie Eilish. That alone is making me want to see it. That's why it was in my dark horse for the summer movie.
What do you think those meetings were like?
Yeah. She was talking about it on Conan. It was like, it was just James Cameron, this big ass camera, and me in my hotel room. And he's the one asking the questions, doing the stuff. Like, he is into it. He is not farming this out to like the B team or anything. Right. It's James Cameron.
It's not Billie
Eilish. Billie Eilish is basically a sunken treasure ship.
Yeah.
She's one of the most valuable treasures of the 20th century. Pretty
She's
much.
Basically a deep sea discovery is what she is.
I have heard that watching this concert film is basically like you're looking at a big window into the concert. That's how realistic.
That's the dream of HFR.
Yeah, that's the dream of HFR. So I really wanted to catch this last week. I'm going to make an effort to watch it this week because it is playing near me and I believe in HFR 3D. So I'm excited. I'm excited because I've heard, this does seem like it would be a better use of HFR than Avatar 3 personally, but we'll see. We'll see. Anyway, thank you for the email, Ryan. And you can always write into /filmcast@gmail.com. All right, folks, let's get going with what we've been watching. I had a chance to see The Devil Wears Prada 2. This is the sequel to the classic comedy starring Anne Hathaway and Meryl Streep. And it's a massive hit. It's probably going to make around $200 million domestically. And I think most of us put it around there in our summer movie wager, so that's pretty good, you know?
But it
looks like it's going to outpace the original film, box office-wise, and that was an open question for us. Like, does it still have the juice? It definitely does. My overall thoughts on the film, it's fine. It's fine. I think the first movie, Devil Wears Prada, is excellent. I think the Devil Wears Prada 1 is virtually a perfect film of its type. Meryl Streep as Miranda Priestley is perfect. It is like she plays this extremely menacing, off-putting, rude, extremely hyper-competent character that can stand no fools. And the first movie sets it up as basically Anne Hathaway playing Andy Sachs, newcomer into this Vogue-esque magazine, and is kind of facing off against Miranda Priestley and trying to survive.
Also, the movie that basically introduced so many people to Emily Blunt, right? Mm. Like, that was one of her first big notable roles, and love her in that.
So I think the first movie is great, and tons of memorable one-liners and memes, and really quite good.
Distinctly not a rom-com, by the way. People keep calling that movie a rom-com. It's a comedy.
Yes.
With women. There's actually no central romance to that movie. It was interesting to me as somebody trying to get into media and publishing. It's like, oh, this world seems terrifying. But it's a comedy.
Yeah, I would say it's a workplace comedy more than it is a romantic comedy, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, Devil Wears Prada 2.
You're telling me that Meryl Streep and she don't fall in love? I feel like they fall in love. Don't they not fall
That would be lovely.
No.
Why can't I think of Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway.
There is
a joke
would have
landed better if I could have remembered the names. Sorry,
the thing is, it's not quite love, but you know that feeling of obsession, of lust, of being terrified of the object of your obsession? It's kind of that. That's what it is.
Yeah. And Devil Wears Prada 2, essentially, you know, if you, very minor spoiler for Devil Wears Prada 1, but at the end of that movie, Anne Hathaway's character figures out a way to get into the world of journalism, right? And it's been now 2 decades later, and guess what, guys? Journalism isn't doing so hot anymore.
It's all gone.
And so...
let's hear about her newsletter.
Let's hear about her Substack. And so circumstances conspire to bring Anne Hathaway's character back into Miranda Priestly's orbit. And also, like, Miranda Priestly's influence is greatly degraded as well. Like, Vogue magazine is no longer... Mm-hmm. Runway magazine is no longer a magazine. It's an app. And so, everyone is dealing with this new challenging situation.
True to life.
And overall, the movie is fine. It's fun. It's a crowd please. If you take your friends to go see it, which is what we did, you'll have a great time. There'll be some occasional laughs. It's totally fine.
Is it about that change kind of in the media landscape? Because I think that would be a really fun part.
You should see the first movie, Jeff.
That is the main plot. And actually, that's one of my beefs with the movie is... Instead of being Miranda Priestly versus Andy Sachs, it is Miranda Priestly and Andy Sachs versus what's going on in the media.
Well, that's how you got to do it. It's every sequel where you kind of bring in the antagonist from the first movie and you got to team up for a bigger threat. That's what it is.
Right. And a lot of people are loving the movie, obviously, and having a great time with it. I will say the fashions in the movie are excellent. They have much better designers this time around. They have the first movie did so well that tons of people wanted to make cameos in this one. And so you can tell the first movie is hugely influential. But I am not as much of a fan of this one because first of all, it does feel I don't like using this phrase, but it is kind of the phrase that comes to mind. Like this movie didn't quote unquote need to exist. Like in my opinion, there was nothing super compelling about why did they need to bring this character back? And then what do you give up? Miranda Priestly in this movie is not the same character. She has evolved into something that is, in my opinion, less interesting. You know, she was an idea, a legend in the first movie. And in this one, she's just a rude boss. And that to me is less interesting. Other people, I made a video about this on my channels, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, and that's fine. I think again, I don't think the movie's bad. We have talked about a lot of legacy sequels, reboots, and many of them have been terrible. This one is not terrible. It is totally fine.
It's interesting if you think about her real world parallels, right? Like Anna Wintour. Is essentially the person that she is based on.
That's right.
She is now has widespread influence over Condé Nast. She is not just the one editor in charge of that. Or even on the tech side, Kara Swisher, who is, a major tech journalist, but now has so many different things. There are other ways.
Who's in the movie, by the way. Kara Swisher.
Of course
she
is.
And I booed.
She's everywhere.
I booed when she appeared because I don't like her.
Good job.
Anyway. Devil Wears Prada 2, it's fine. It's not bad, nor is it great. I think the first one is great. I think the first one is an excellent film that I would recommend to basically anyone. And this one, if you want to see the same characters come back and do the same little song and dance that they did in the first film, then that's going to be fine. You're going to get what you want. But in my opinion, it's we're always wondering for these reboots or Lego sequels or sequels, are they going to be super sad? Are they going to be just okay? Or are they going to be great? They're rarely great. They're almost never great, right? They're often bad. This one is just fine. So
you just want to see the band get back together.
Yeah, if you want to see the band get back together, that's totally a legitimate thing you want to do. And but as an example, I think there's very few one-liners in this movie. Like, the first movie had so many great one-liners that people still repeat today. And instead, the second movie just has references to the first movie's one-liners. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really have new one-liners. So
that's a bummer. Yeah. That's the like a sequel trap.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, hey, remember like, when
hey,
I said
remember?
The, remember when I said the funny thing 20 years ago? You know, like it's not, it's not like that explicit, but it's like, you know, it's invoking a memory of a thing you laughed at before as opposed to like trying to make you laugh again. All right, anyway, not bad, not bad. Devil Wears Prada 2, it is in theaters right now. Check it out. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more of what we've been watching right after this.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by Quince. You know, lately, I've been a little bit more intentional about what I wear day to day. And that's because I don't just want to feel comfortable. Comfortability is the key, but not just comfortability. I want it to feel easy, comfortable, but I want to look good. It just makes getting dressed simpler, but also sometimes comfortable makes it look like you didn't care. That you didn't put any effort into it, that you're just, you know, rolling down the street, picking up my kids, going out into the world, looking like I just threw on, you know, basically my pajamas. And that's not okay anymore for me. Quince makes it easy. Their fabrics feel elevated. The fits are clean. Everything just works. Without needing to overthink it. And it's so comfortable. It's so simple. I just got the Mongolian cashmere quarter zip. I already have a crew neck that I like. And their jacket. Oh my gosh. I got this incredible all-weather jacket that just works for me here in Colorado. It's my go-to jacket now. Quince has all the wardrobe staples that are ready for spring. This is what I'm excited about. Now I'm going to start picking up shorts and t-shirts, warmer weather stuff. This is like, you know, 100% European linen shorts, shirts from $34, lightweight, breathable, comfortable, but you still look put together. You still look fashionable, sharp, and clean, 100% Pima cotton tees with a softness that you have to feel, that you got to love, that my wife really likes. Their pants also hit that same balance. Relaxed, comfortable, still polished enough to wear pretty much anywhere. And everything is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen. So you're getting premium materials without the markup. Anybody who knows me will tell you, I am frugal. I don't like spending money on myself when it comes to clothes, but I also want to look sharp. And that's why Quince is perfect. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/filmcast for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's Quince, Quince.com/filmcast for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/filmcast.
Devendra Hardwar, hit us up with something you've been watching this week.
Yeah, I guess I got sidetracked on my quest to see something about the devil. I watched The Terror season 3, Devil in Silver. And
Silver
we have not really
Prada?
Could be. It's a silver door. It's a stylish silver door. It is very stylish.
Speaking about Narnia.
This is the third season of the ongoing
Silver Chair. Silver Chair. Okay.
Third season of this show. We've never really talked about The Terror before, even though I think people love this series. Like, this is an anthology of like different horror stories. The first one was on like a ship that was kind of haunted. The second one was in a Japanese internment camp that was just that setting. Seemed really interesting. So I've always meant to get into this series. It just keeps kind of floating by. I think it was also on AMC Plus for a while. So it was harder to watch than other things. This one, Devil in Silver, is on Shudder and it's on AMC Plus. And it stars Dan Stevens. So that alone was like, oh, that's interesting. Dan Stevens doing like a weird horror thing again. It stars Dan Stevens as a working class guy who is wrongfully arrested and thrown into an old school mental hospital, very much a mental asylum, the things that don't really exist anymore. And that's a little bit weird. It's a little bit creepy, maybe a little bit haunted. And I think it's really effective. I've seen the first few episodes. The first few, I believe, were directed by Karen Kusama. So it's kind of interesting to see her doing like, you know, major work again, and written by Victor Lavelle based on his book. And I really like his horror stories. He's done a bunch of like modern and more culturally aware takes on like H.P. Lovecraft. So I like Victor Lavelle quite a bit. These first few episodes are really well made. Kind of creepy. The supporting cast is pretty great too. Hey, Stephen Root once again.
Woo!
Creepy guy in a creepy show. We got our double Stephen Root this season, so that's kind of great.
Doesn't it also have Angela from who's the boss? Judith Light? Isn't Judith Light in the show?
Judith Light is in this.
She Angela. Has, I was like, Tony Danza is in
Samantha. Mona. Judith Light
is in this. Hey, if you want to hear Dan Stevens give a terrible, terrible New York accent, it's very much what you're doing, Jeff. It's very much like Dan Stevens watched a lot of Who's the Boss, and that is his New York accent. And it also comes in and out. It fades in and out, too. I love Dan Stevens as an actor. He has never been very good at accents. So anyway, rounding things out, Asif Manvi is the head of this psychiatry ward. He's the sort of doctor trying to keep things in charge. CCH Pounder is in this, is one of the nurses kind of trying to keep things together. Just a really interesting cast all around. And I think like a very compelling story. It is not exactly that scary. And from the reviews I've read from people who've seen the entire series, like, I don't think it'll really add up to much. But hey, Dan Stevens in a horror thing in a TV show, that's kind of interesting. So it was enough for me to check out a couple episodes. I'll try to finish it up. But I wish it was scarier. I wish it felt a little different. I don't know. But the Dan Stevens of it all, the cast is really interesting. I'll watch a few more episodes to see where this is going.
I feel like Dan Stevens is better than most of the projects he's involved in.
He loves being a weird little guy. He was in the Godzilla.
So many things. I don't know what he's getting offered. I don't, you know, he doesn't feel like he's really broken through as a real A-list talent, but I think he deserves it. I think
he wants this though. He wants to exist in the sort of like B-tier, pop up in a horror thing, pop in a thriller thing.
Favorite thing that Dan Stevens has been in, go. What do you guys
think? Oh my God, I have to.
I'll start with mine is The Guest. That's my favorite, but Dan Stevens. Oh,
yeah.
Let me just see what else he's got. Part,
like a thriller movie that was directed by Adam Wingard.
He was the best thing about Godzilla X-Kong.
I mean, that movie's terrible.
Him being the sort of like monster observer, I guess, who like parachutes in. Trying to think here.
Yeah.
Apostle was great.
Oh, yeah. He was really great in that as well. Jeff, very did you watch Apostle? Did we review that on the podcast?
No, we didn't. We didn't have a full review, but that is a bad.
Well, Jeff,
movie.
Here's what it sounds like. It sounds like you haven't seen the best Dan Stevens things.
Well, Legion. What was the what's the crazy horror movie with like action-y horror movie that he did?
Oh, yeah.
That's my Cuckoo? Favorite one. I can't remember the name of it.
That's the guest. But he's also in Cuckoo last year.
Cuckoo from a couple years ago.
No, The Guest is the best Dan Stevens thing.
Okay.
For sure.
I agree. Also, he was in Abigail, a movie that was not widely appreciated, but I enjoyed. It was by the Radio Silence guys. Anyway, okay. The show is The Terror, Devil in Silver. It's on AMC. Devendra likes it.
And Shudder.
So, oh, yeah. And it's something that Devendra Hardwar has been watching this week. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you watched this week.
I watched a documentary, a relatively new documentary on Peacock called
we'll Make It a Thing.
Gesundheit. Downey wrote that. I, as you guys, I'm sure, have gathered over the many years of me talking about various Saturday Night Live related things, Saturday Night Live, pretty big deal for me in my life and very formative. And I think I've also mentioned that I constantly have weird dreams that I'm hosting Saturday Night Live. It's very pathetic and sad. But I love Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live is an institution, as a thing I'm fascinated by. I love learning about behind the scenes things, stories from the make. It's just such a unique organism in media. You know, there's nothing else like Saturday Night Live. And it has been such a big part of culture, such a big farm farm program for the world of comedy and mm-hmm. you know, finding people that have influenced the world of comedy over decades of, you know, 50 years now. So I'm always fascinated to watch anything that kind of digs a little behind the scenes about Saturday Night Live. And Downey Wrote That is about Jim Downey, the periodic head writer of Saturday Night Live, and really a just monster talent in terms of comedy writing and influencing the people that are much more notable. He's a name that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. They probably know his face. Most people know Jim Downey as the guy who said, "And we are all stupider for having heard that famous." Yes.
I award you no points and may God have mercy on your soul.
That's right, from Billy Madison.
Although recently he's gone viral for that Conan clip where he claims to not know who Jeffrey Epstein is.
The Epstein clip is amazing.
Yeah. It's so funny.
Jeffrey Epstein, the financier?
Yeah, so funny. And he has a speaking role, pretty large speaking role in The Chair. Chair Company. Anyway, he has had a outsized influence on so much of the world of comedy. And Downey Wrote That, the title implies, many of your favorite sketches from Saturday Night Live, Downey wrote that. And this documentary is all about, you know, him and his life and how he got into that place. You know, he was one of those Harvard comedy writer guys that worked on the Lampoon and was the head writer on the Lampoon for many years in his youth. And, you know, he wrote for David Letterman. He wrote, he's had a storied career, and so many of the people you know in Saturday Night Live idolize him. And, you know, he took under his wing. He was a guy who literally would have open office hours on Saturday Night Live where people would be coming up with sketches and they would just go to him, his office, and be like, "Is this any good?" And it's a fun, if like me, you sort of love Saturday Night Live, you have a lot of fond memories of great sketches throughout the years that you recall, this documentary is basically exactly what I wanted, in that it is like, "Hey, remember that sketch? Oh my God, I love that sketch. I haven't thought about that sketch in years. Oh, it's so great." And it shows these sketches over time, you know, in the storied history of Saturday Night Live. And it has, you know, it interviews everybody. It really has a who's who, murderer's row of great comedians. They interview Lorne Michaels and, you know, it's Dana Carvey, right down the line, all talking about how Jim Downey influenced their career and what makes his writing special. So I think this is a very fun documentary if you like Saturday Night Live, or if you're curious about how it works. I don't know if, you know, if you're not a fan of Saturday Night Live, if you'll get anything out of this, but you probably wouldn't watch it anyway. But it's good fun. And I was laughing so much. They just show the sketches in full, some of the sketches in full. And it's just like, oh my God, yes, I love that sketch. You know, he wrote Colon Blow, and he wrote, you know, just like,
yeah, love Colon Blow.
Colon Blow is amazing. It's a fake commercial with the late Phil Hartman.
Phil Hartman, yeah. I think about that every time I eat my shredded wheat in the morning.
Right?
Yes.
Like, there's
they should
so
just keep airing
many,
that because we need it. We still need it.
So many classic, just like iconic, stick in your brain for decades at a time sketches that he wrote. And then, you know, David Letterman talks about how big of a deal. He only wrote on David Letterman, I think, for a year, and not even a whole year, but like how big of a deal it was that he helped shape the sort of irreverent comedy stylings of David Letterman in those early years. And so it's great. It gets into all of that, his relationship with various people, him writing, you know, I think one of the most, what's the word I want? Iconic, I guess, is it. But my favorite stretches of any Saturday Night Live thing is Norm MacDonald doing Weekend Update.
Yeah.
And evidently, Jim Downey and Norm MacDonald had this incredible bond. And basically, all of those Weekend Update jokes that you love, all of the, you know, incessant pounding on the O.J. Simpson trial. And
yep.
All of the jokes.
The kids would not understand what was going on there with Norm. Oh, and
dude, it was so, it's so funny. And they show so much of it. And it's like, it's so funny and biting and sharp and, you know, and bold, brave, you know, like fearless comedy writing. And they literally, the guy who ran NBC was like, stop doing this. I'm firing you.
Yeah.
And those guys are like, oh, you want us to stop pounding on your best friend, OJ Simpson? Okay. We'll do it more, you know? And
yeah,
it was, so, like, it was relentless.
Just
OJ Simpson, the football player.
Yeah. Incredible. Like you know, the joke after the verdict came down, where, you know, if Norm MacDonald's sitting there and he goes, well, it turns out murder is legal in the state of California.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's so funny.
It was also saying stuff that, like, they couldn't say on the news, right? Like,
right. Yes.
Like, yep. They couldn't. Yeah. And I mean, now people are like relitigating the whole O.J. Simpson thing yet again. But
yeah,
it is. I'm sorry, folks. It's pretty clear he was guilty of that crime.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's obviously
and,
guilty.
The joke
is Norm MacDonald just stating the obvious to everyone.
But people weren't, when I was growing up, it was like people weren't saying that on like major news. There was literally, I remember my local news. It was like from 10 to 10:30, and then they launched a half hour afterwards just to talk about the O.J. Simpson case.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, it was a media phenomenon.
People to fathom. If you didn't live through it, it's hard to fathom what happened to our culture during that period
TVs
of time.
TVs were pulled out in the middle of school to announce the end of that trial. And I was in middle school.
Literally, there is nothing, there's very little that compare. Very little that compares in terms of like how pervasive it was in the culture.
Pervasive is
the
word.
The O.J. Simpson.
So good.
The O.J. Simpson trial. Like, I'm trying. Yeah. I was going to bring up an analogy, but like, honestly, it would not be. People would be offended if I brought up this analogy, but like, go ahead, Jeff. What are you saying?
So the analogy for what you were talking about initially, which is the reluctance to just state the obvious.
Yes.
That's happening right now with our president and
absolutely
his guilt over many things. But
I miss Norm so much. Norm would have a field day with all of this bullshit.
Oh, dude, what I wouldn't give for Norm MacDonald and Jim Downey to be doing, you know, whatever. But like, they literally lost their jobs because they wouldn't back down from the truth. And like, how great is that? You know, it's a big part of this documentary, and it reminds me, you know, how what comedy can be when it's not just slurping power, when it actually is the court jester, when it actually is there to undermine power and provide a voice to the unvoiced, you know, and there's still some people doing that, but I think it's much rarer these days. I just saw an interview with
Zach Galifianakis,
when he was like, he was on the Conan podcast, and he's like, these guys who do podcasts and they bring the president on and they're just like fake laughing at his dumb jokes and not doing the thing that comedy is supposed to do, which is exactly what Jim Downey and Norm MacDonald did, which is literally speak truth to power, literally use a freaking dagger to poke at power. And it's great. So this documentary really gets into that. And you realize this kind of unassuming kind of Midwestern looking dude who just, if you saw Jim Downey walk into the room, you probably wouldn't think he's one of the funniest humans on the planet, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet he's responsible for so many of the things in our culture, at least from a certain, you know, perspective.
Yeah. Anyway. I need to check this out, Jeff. I do want to say, like, now that I think about it, and you bring up, like, all that Downey's responsible for, especially the Norm connection, that is the thing that has directly affected my life. Like, I am in situations where I am talking to powerful people, you know, like, directly talking to them. And I see a lot of people, like, journalists and other people, like, not really bringing up touchy things, not really diving into it, and that ability to just like say the thing that everyone's trying to avoid, it's very useful when reporting and when doing things, and not enough people do it. So I wish there were more of that. I feel like I can trace that back to hearing Norm MacDonald, the stuff he wrote with Downey. Yeah.
Dude, and there's so much great, like there's sketches I haven't thought about that I absolutely love. Do you guys remember that? It's an older one from the Carvey era as well, but it's a fake commercial for the change bank that is a bank that only gives change. Mm. And it's just guys, you know, talking in completely serious deadpan about like, you can come into the bank with a 20. We'll give you 2 tens or 2 fives and a 10. We'll even give you 5 ones, 1 5 and a 10. It's like, it is like, and it goes on and on, just explaining all the different ways you can get change from the change. It's so funny. So, you know, he has the like biting political humor, the sharp cultural scalpel, but he also has just like goofy, silly. It's great. So I recommend Downey wrote that on Peacock.
Downey wrote that, name of the documentary. Something Jeff Canada has been watching this week. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this. Guys, I had a chance to watch The Sheep Detectives.
Yeah. This week.
I'm jealous because I do want to see this.
I've heard this is very good.
Yeah.
Sheep Detectives, I think it has a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yep.
Kind of came out of nowhere. Let me paint a picture for you. The guy who directed Minions, the movie, makes this movie that's written by the guy who made Chernobyl and The Last of Us TV shows.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. It's a feel good hit of the summer.
Feel good hit, talking animals, bring the kids. It's a talking animal movie. How bad, like how rough can it be?
It's right? About
the backstory of the talking sheep, though, is that they had, you know, radioactive fallout from a terrible disease.
Oh, just wait, Jeff.
Actually sheep zombies. They came back to life and they're eating everyone. Sheep Detectives is about a herd of sheep that need to solve the murder of their shepherd.
Hugh Jackman is murdered in this movie.
Hugh Jackman
is murdered in this movie. It's like a children's movie.
The sheep need to solve his murder, and that is
Hugh Jackman can't be murdered. He has a healing factor, Davidra.
This movie is a blast. I mean, apparently, just to be clear, Craig Mazin, who is the creator of shows like Chernobyl and The Last of Us TV show, has been working on this for like a very, very long time, like many, many years, and it has finally come to fruition. And the movie is very, very fun. It's very good. It is going to reward people who are into murder mysteries. Like, it has like, here are the rules of any murder mystery, and the sheep are trying to figure it out. I'm not going to reveal the ways in which they play into the plot at all. There's, you know, and there's a lot of sheep humor as well. If you're into like sheep related humor,
sure,
right? Making fun of the fact that they're sheep.
What if Babe, but there is a murder in it? I love the pitch of this movie. The animals are realistically talking, and somebody died.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Bring the kids.
You can bring the kids. I will tell you that
that'll whodunit pig. No, I'm trying. I'm trying.
That's good, Jeff. That was pretty good.
Yeah, I tried.
I will say, I do think this is a pretty good family film. When I went to go see it, there were many, you know, the theater was like 2/3 full. There were many families that were there. But yes, it does deal with a murder. I will say the murder is not graphic. Like, it doesn't show like, oh, he's got a huge gash in his stomach or anything. You know, like, it's done in a way that...
It's a light off-screen murder. Off-screen murder.
That's right. Like, it's done in a way that it's like, oh, they knew people would be taking their kids to go see
There's no sheep autopsy scene.
It used to be, you go to a kid's movie, somebody get murdered, right? You go to the Lion King. That's a murder.
Yeah.
That's a murder. You watch Bambi, first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's a murder.
Yeah.
Kids get used to it. You're going to get got in this world.
Yeah.
Davidra's platform is make kids' movies murder again.
Listen, it prepared us. What did those movies prepare us for? A world that's completely falling apart. So you got to get the kids a little more resilient over here.
But what I'm saying is, yes, there are a couple of scary sequences that I'm not going to explain what they are because it's spoiler. Aren't the murder. That's right. Okay. So, you know, I would say like the youngest of the young kids, like it's probably not a good idea to take them. But, you know, if I certainly like late elementary, middle school, I think they can probably handle the sheep detectives. And the movie is very fun. It's if you like murder mysteries, it's fun. If you like sheep humor, it's fun. The cast is wonderful. It's just a classic kind of screwball comedy that's also a murder mystery involving sheep. I don't know. It's just such a silly premise that it's like it's inherently amusing on its own. All the sheep casting, by the way, is mind blowing. Like, I'm Patrick Stewart is one of the sheep, you know?
Still bald, but yeah, he's a sheep.
By the way, just so you guys know, the way it works is, Bryan Cranston, by the way, another one of the sheep. The way it works is that the sheep can hear and understand humans, but humans can't understand the sheep.
These are called Babe rules. So we've all seen Babe.
The sheep can talk to each other, right? But like humans can't understand what they're doing. So the sheep have their own little world and culture with all the rules, and it's fun to learn about all those things. So fun movie. Doesn't make sense for there to be a sequel, but I could see there be an ongoing world of sheep detective movies.
It's really funny. This is in theaters at the same time as Andy Serkis's Animal Farm.
That's right.
His children's movie Animal Farm.
Just like, yeah.
I feel like we got to watch that just to deconstruct what happened here. Because
supposedly Andy Serkis's dream project that he's been dreaming about for decades of his life.
This is what you've been dreaming about, Andy Serkis?
It's weird.
Yeah. Apparently not very good, just to be clear. Animal Farm.
Apparently horrific. Like, not just not good, like, fundamentally not Animal Farm. Like, anyway.
Somebody relighted it. Somebody was like, yes.
Well, no, it's Angel Studios. So it's like the religious studios. He's doing this for that studio that makes all the religious movies. I'm so baffled by this entire story.
Well, you know what movie isn't horrific? Sheep Detectives. It's a blast. It's fun for the whole family. As long as your kids are okay with the concept of murder and it's not very graphic. Family murder time. A lot of fun. Like, I think this is going to be one of those movies that's like not quite Paddington 2 level, you know, but like approaching that where people are discovering this for years. They're like, there's a sheep detective movie and the blah, blah, blah. And, you know,
it doesn't really sell itself. Like, the concept isn't one I think you gravitate toward.
Right.
But, you know, the quality may just give it legs, so to speak.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you guys have seen the trailer for this, but I saw this video. I was like, Hugh Jackman's doing like a Babe movie? That's interesting. He's murdered within the middle of the trailer. Like, what is happening here? And the sheep are like, I guess we got to figure out this murder in our kids' movie.
I'm going to put this out there, too. It feels like a throwback to an earlier Hollywood era, right? Yeah. When you'd be a writer, you'd get into a room to pitch a movie, and you'd be like, you know, and Hugh Jackman's a shepherd and he gets murdered and the sheep need to solve the crime. It's like high concept.
Gremlins 2 vibe.
Right. It's like a high
doing
concept.
Rails in the guy's office. Yeah,
that's right.
And then, oh man. And then Hugh Jackman is murdered. I don't know.
Can't kill Wolverine.
Who's going to solve the murder? I don't know. Look around. Who we got? We got sheep. Let's do it.
It's the Sheep Detectives. And it is out in theaters right now. Check it out. Devendra Hardwar, something else you've been watching this week?
Yeah, something I've been watching. My kids have become fans of the How to Train Your Dragon movies.
Mm.
And I do want to ask you guys, have you heard of Dragons? DreamWorks Dragons. Long-running TV series.
Series, yeah. No,
Race
we haven't
to
watched
the TV
series. There are 8 seasons of this show.
Mackerel.
The principal cast from How to Train Your Dragon is in this entire series, which is wild to me. So Jay Baruchel, America Ferrera, Christopher Mintz-Plasse. You get a lot of TJ Miller in the show too. Like all the main folks except
but on the downside, TJ Miller is also
on the downside. You get a lot of TJ Miller. So my kids are. This is the current show that my kids are just watching over and over and over. And the show itself seems fine. It's like nowhere near the level of the movies, but it is wild to me that this thing exists and was popular enough to support 8 seasons. I believe the first 2 seasons were Cartoon Network, and then the 3 through 8. Is on Netflix, and that's what you're seeing right now. I'm not sure if they're all available on Netflix, but like decent enough adventure kid story, which continues the journey of Toothless and everybody. They discover more dragons, they're more villains. It's very much in the template of a traditional kid show, but man, this is just totally blind to me. Like David Chen, I thought you were the world's biggest How to Train Your Dragon fan. How many of these episodes have you seen?
I have not seen any of them, Devendra.
I think my kids are now bigger How to Train Your Dragon fans.
Well, that is, it's very shameful. You're right. And I should get right to work. How did you watch the show, Devendra? Is it on like Paramount
Plus? It's
on
Netflix.
Peacock?
Race to the Edge is on Netflix. And it's perfectly fine. It's not like transcendent kids TV stuff, but it's good enough. Like if you miss some of that How to Train Your Dragon's juice, if you miss Toothless and the other folks, like it'll do. It'll do.
A little better than just watching it again as a live action movie.
Yeah, I don't Yeah, we're making some choices in our culture right now, aren't we? And also, like, weirdly, this series was coming out, like, up until, like, 2018, I believe. Certain things happen in How to Train Your Dragon 2. Certain principal characters die. Not so in this show. So that whole drama of what happened there, which was a big thing, watching the movie, I was like, huh, that's it. So it is set before How to Train Your Dragon 2. There's a whole timeline of things happening here. Just really, really weird and really funny, because I guess we're not going to... I guess murder is too much of a concept for a kids show. You know, they're just trying to be safe over here.
You know what's wild? TJ Miller, first of all, he has a section in his Wikipedia page called Controversies. And that's generally not a heading.
There are multiple Wikipedia entries just for controversies?
You don't want there to be enough controversies for it to warrant a section.
For it to be plural.
And also, apparently, his voice was removed from the third How to Train Your Dragon film and dubbed over by another actor. Because
it could have been done by literally anyone. So totally. The headings for those controversies. You want to read those aloud?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there is the physical assault allegation and sexual assault allegation. I mean, those are very upsetting and bad, but many people have those. However, there's also Amtrak bomb threat incident, which
a little bit outside the norm.
Yeah, but. Anyway, I'm surprised that his voice is, you know, I guess it would cost a lot of money to go back through eight seasons.
I mean, these shows were released between 2010 and, like, 2018. So it was
before Amtrak.
Before, like,
bombed.
He was fully before canceled.
Amtrak bomb, yeah. Before Amtrak bomb threat incident happened on Wikipedia. All right. Anyway, that's Dragons, Race to the Edge. It's something Devendra Hardwar has been watching. Jeff Cannata, you and Devendra both this week have played a video game that many people have described as movie-esque.
Yeah, every once in a while we bring up a video game in the show, and usually that's because the video game fits a little bit more into our purview here. And I think Mixtape is a prime example of that. This is a video game. I finished it in about 3 hours, and it's a very brief video game. It's very linear. It's very cinematic. It uses the language of cinema, and it is very much a movie that you are familiar with, a movie genre you're familiar with, and not a movie genre, not a video game genre that's done very often. Frankly, video games often don't even delve into this kind of thing. This is a sort of coming of age, teen comedy. It is much more in line with something John Hughes would have made in the 80s and early 90s. It takes place in the late 90s, 1999, I believe.
And I think they're going for, like, undefined time, but, like, vaguely 90s. It's like follows a little bit. Because things can get weird. Yeah.
We've got mixtapes are still a thing.
Right.
But CDs. It's not really tapes. This is she's burning CDs. You know, remember burning CDs?
That was so good. I think I remember the last CD I burned or DVD I burned because it was a time.
In college, we burned so many CDs. I bought spools of blank CDs burn.
We all did. They towered on our bookcases.
But what was cool about the burned CDs, and I just watched the Bear TV surprise drop called Gary, and they had a burned CD is a key part of the plot of that, or a key part of the atmosphere of that. The key part of burned CDs is you got to share them with other people, right? Yes. Like you could physically give a burn CD and be like, hey, this, like, represents me in some way. And yes, you have playlists today that kind of do the same thing, but it's not really the same.
It's not.
It took effort.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was called burning. Like it was like you were casting a spell.
You're literally manipulating the atoms on this, like, CD surface, you know?
Ah. Gosh, every time we threw a party when I was in college, every time we threw a party at our house, and it was a drama party. So it wasn't, don't get crazy, but we would burn a CD of everybody in our house. We had seven dudes living in one house.
Wow.
Everybody would contribute songs to the CD for the party. Right. Oh, what a time.
Awesome.
What a time we had. That is the era that is evoked in Mixtape, and the central character, this is a story about three friends. But the central character, the character that breaks the fourth wall and speaks directly to you, it dreams of being a musical director, someone who is
Music supervisor, I believe.
Music supervisor. Yeah, someone who's compiling music for Hollywood or for, you know, like someone who collects eclectic songs, puts them into a playlist, puts them onto a mixtape or CD, and, you know, creates a mood that evolves over time. And so that is the device that is used to express this video game, where each section of the video game is tied to a song. And these are real licensed songs. Some of my favorite songs in the world. I mean, it has Joy Division and Susie and the Banshees and Smashing Pumpkins. And it's very eclectic music. It's not all 90s music. And it is really effective. I think the game is beautiful. It uses, like I said, the language of cinema. So there's long cutscenes. The interactivity is not what you would typically expect from a video game. There's no fail state. There's no winning. There's no score kept. There's no challenge, really. It's not about challenge. It's just about using the fact that you are involved, the fact that you have some interactivity here, to help express the mood. So you get to do things. And I found it to be very effective in bringing me into the experience, because I'm actually asked to do a few things. Now, and again, if you're looking for a challenge, or if you're looking for what typically video games do, this is not it. It is much closer to a pure narrative experience. But I absolutely love this game. I was crying at the end. I found it to be, I mean, these it's three friends. They're these disaffected kind of, you know, 90s kind of emo kid. Not emo, but they're just kind of.
They're like, yeah, they're breaking the rules.
Yeah, they're just kind of grunge kids. And I didn't have their exact experience, but it was evocative of my own experience in high school and college. And it really brought me back and made me nostalgic for that feeling. And the game uses a lot of flights of fancy. It is not grounded in a naturalistic experience. And, you know, there's moments where the kids literally lift off from the ground and fly through the air. But it is these kind of dreamlike flights of fancy that convey a feeling. And it's that feeling of being a very specific age that we've all been through, that we all felt big, big feelings. And the world was more, you know, tightly wound, and it just felt like everything, our whole lives were in front of us, you know? So anyway, I loved it. I'm curious what you thought, Devendra.
Oh yeah. Love it as well. I've not finished it yet. I've heard it's pretty short, so I'm pretty sure I'm like just going to wrap it up soon. I will say though, Jeff, there have been a bunch of games similar to this. And that is, I'm thinking a lot of like Life is Strange. There have been a lot of games about like disaffected kids just trying to find their place in the world for some reason, always set in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know why that is. It's always like going back to Gone Home, I think, which was one of those first like really big narrative like games.
Yeah.
What is it about the Pacific Northwest that just really captures that moment of nostalgia and childhood? I don't know. Every time I visit, by the way, it does feel like it would be great to live here.
I've been watching The Sopranos as comfort watching.
Famously set in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, there's this episode where one of, you know, trigger warning, conversation about self-harm. But there's a episode where one of Tony Soprano's ex-girlfriends commits suicide. Mm-hmm. And one day Tony Soprano's like eating with his sister. And he says, "You ever know anyone who commits suicide?" And she says, "Please, Tony, I'm from Seattle." And I was like, what is that supposed to mean exactly? You know, I'm always curious, like, how people think of Seattle, right? Like depressing and, you know.
Well, it's dreary, it's rainy. I think big part of the reason, Devendra, is that you always want that scene where they like go out into the woods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to have nature. You have to have good nature, but also like small town Americana vibes. Yeah. But you don't want to be in like Oklahoma. You want to be by water. Yeah. You got to have a bay of some kind. Like,
yeah.
It's just interesting how we've seen this formula repeated a couple of times. It's kind of the magic of Twin Peaks as well. Like, ooh, what is going on? in the Pacific
Northwest. Yeah, there being a lot of water, I guess, does. It is called the Emerald City, you know, because of how lush and green things are. Gateway to the Pacific, another word that is used.
So, but anyway. It's never in Seattle. It's like these little towns.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
They're just like offshoot suburbs.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it's like every time you want your horror in Maine and the East Coast,
right.
You want your, you know, your
coming of age.
Yeah, coming of age on the West Coast. But also serial killers on the West Coast. That's where the whole idea of serial killers came about, because they were living in the Pacific Northwest. It just drove them insane.
There was a show called The Killing set in Seattle. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, Peter. Yeah. The game is very good. It's very evocative. It's very moving. Very much about that, like, it makes you think to, there was this one day where everything changed. And I think you live long enough and you experience that. And I can trace back to those moments where like friend relationships change or life changes happen, and you don't know it when you're living through it, right? It is in hindsight, you're like, oh, that was a big deal. You know, the day before I moved or something, like maybe you just didn't fully understand how big of an impact that would be. And this game is fully all about that. So I'm loving it. Love the soundtrack. Highly recommended. I know Patrick Klepek over at Remap has written and talked a lot about this too. I believe he interviewed the devs too. So It's a tremendous game. Go play it, especially if you like Life is Strange. And I was going to catch up on that series because there have been a whole bunch I've missed.
I mean, it really is a video game for people that don't usually play video games as well. It is much more a pure narrative experience, and I think beautifully delivered with some just tremendous music, tremendous moments.
By Johnny Galvatron, by the way, of the Galvatrons. Like, I always find that funny that he's doing games now.
Very cool. Well, that's Mixtape. It's a new video game that Jeff and Divendra have been enjoying, and you can find it at mixtape.game, and you can get it for whatever platform you have available to you. And that is what we've been watching this week. Let's take one more break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more of the podcast right after this. It's time to get to weekly plugs. We're going to do weekly plugs. Plugs. Weekly plugs, a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. I just want to throw a shout out for my Mortal Kombat 2 written review over at decodingeverything.com. Decodingeverything.com, my free newsletter that anyone can subscribe to that keeps track of everything I'm doing around the internet, as well as my reviews of the latest films that are out in theaters. So check it out, decodingeverything.com. I kind of dive into my history with the game and how I felt about it and how I ended up feeling about the film. So check it out, decodingeverything.com. Devendra Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, check out the Engadget podcast. We just recently talked about the kind of wildest news last week of GameStop CEO saying, hey, I think I'm going to buy eBay. We're going to make that happen.
Half stock.
Read the website. We talk about this crazy news because GameStop is barely a company right now. It is a meme stock lifted up by kind of a charlatan CEO. And there's a lot to talk about there. So me and Engadget's Daniel Cooper discussed it. There is a CNBC interview with that guy that is one of the wildest things I've ever seen, like in just like dry financial news and financial journalism. So we had a good chat about all this. So check that out, the Engadget podcast.
Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug?
Limericks. Get your limericks. Get them while they're hot. They will be hot. They will always be hot because I make them fresh for you over at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. Any occasion. Limerick is great. And I did some for Mother's Day. We got Father's Day coming up. It's great for birthdays. It's great just for a pick-me-up. Whatever you need, I'm here for you. I'll make a limerick to your specifications, deliver it via video. cameo.com/Jeff Cannata.
Apropos of nothing, guys, did you know that Mortal Kombat is based off an old Nordic church song? Did you know that Mortal Kombat is based off an old Nordic church song? Just an open question for you. Anyway, I do want to throw a shout out for patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can get ad-free episodes, exclusive After Darks, and early access episodes whenever we can manage it. Again, patreon.com/filmpodcast. Of course, we never want anyone to donate. If in any way it causes them financial hardship, you can always support us for free by leaving a star rating for us or a review wherever you get your podcasts. That said, thank you to anyone who helps to keep the show going in any way. We really appreciate it. It's time to get to our review of Mortal Kombat 2.
You want to know what makes a hero? It's not destiny. It's not something you're born with. It's searching for greatness.
Johnny Cage, you have been chosen for Mortal Kombat.
Then realizing you've had it in you this entire time.
Whoa! I really don't feel comfortable hitting a girl.
Don't worry. You won't.
It's a finish him.
Finish him.
To finish him.
Wow. Well played. That's well done, actually.
Yeah, I like that
one. That's from the bowels of Reddit. Anyway, thank you for tuning into the Filmcast review of Mortal Kombat 2. I'm going to read the plot summary of this movie from IMDb. The fan favorite champions, now joined by Johnny Cage himself, are pitted against one another in the ultimate battle to defeat the dark rule of Shao Kahn that threatens the very existence of the Earthrealm and its defenders. Mortal Kombat 2 is a sequel to the first film that came out a few years ago that set up the Mortal Kombat tournament. That was what happened at the end of that film.
Surf Dracula, that first movie? Right. That first movie is all set up. All set up. No tournament.
Yeah.
Right. So for those who don't know, this is something that Devendra and I talked about in our forthcoming conversation with Simon McCoy. But there was a tweet that went viral a few years ago that said, quote, back in the day, if you did a TV show called Surf Dracula, you'd see that fool surfing every week in new adventures. But in the streaming era, the entire first season got to be a long ass flashback to how he got the surfboard until you finally get to see him surf for 5 minutes in the finale, end quote. The entire first movie of Mortal Kombat was Surf Dracula prepping for the second movie of Mortal Kombat when we finally get to see the tournament.
Yeah. Starring a new character we've never heard about either. So
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we did hear about him in the first film, but like he wasn't a.
What I mean, though. Cole Young, starring an actor, yeah, Louis Tan. I love Louis Tan, but nobody gives a fuck about Cole Young. I'm sorry.
Cole Young Hive, rise up and comment.
And tell us what you think of this movie.
Yeah, tell Devendra Hardwar what you think. Okay, all that said, Devendra Hardwar, we're finally at the tournament.
Yeah.
It's finally the thing that all Mortal Kombat fans have dreamed of for years. Again, because we've done that before.
We got it in the very first movie.
But anyways, it's here again in the modern era. What did you think of Mortal Kombat 2?
So, you know, I'm probably going to be in the minority here and just saying this movie freaking rips. I think, like, you're making a Mortal Kombat movie, you're going to know what you're doing here. You're not remaking The Godfather. You know, you are taking something that is inherently stupid and campy and just trying to make a story of it. I saw the first reboot and I thought it was perfectly fine. Some of the fight scenes were good and like some of the ways they built up the characters were interesting, but it totally missed like what people want from Mortal Kombat, which is the vibe and a bit of that camp too, and also the tournament. And let me tell you, now that that table setting is done, this movie just gets to focus on the fun stuff. So you get all the tournament. You get some really upgraded fight scenes too. I love the choreography. I love a lot of the action in this movie. We talked about it in our interview. And like I clocked it. It's like you're doing something different here. And Simon McCoy mentioned that like they spent a lot more time designing those fight scenes. Like they just put a little more effort into it. And I think you can really tell here. The biggest downside of this movie is that it does not stand on its own. If you've not seen the first reboot, it is completely nonsensical. You just won't understand what's going on because they don't even take time to really set things up. But for what it is, like I had a really great time with it. The way they incorporate fatalities, the way they use the environments for some of the fights. This is a movie where the fighting is more important than the talking. And I think like a lot of great martial arts movies, like that is the thing that reveals character and tells you things, even if it's not the words people are saying. So I found all that great. And also, Mr. Carl Urban, who I've loved forever, I was amazed when they picked him as Johnny Cage because He always seemed like the guy like you will throw into a B movie project, right? The guy you'll throw into your fantasy or sci-fi thing, and he'll accompany the lead, right? He'll be next to The Rock in Dune. He'll be the guy fighting Jason Bourne. He'll be not the captain of the Star Trek Enterprise, but just, you know, one of the side characters there. Carl Urban, always around, and I've always loved his work. And this gives him like practically a starring role. Like, he is the centerpiece of that poster, and he is a guy that knows exactly what project he's in every single time, right? You're Johnny Cage. You're not a beloved character. In fact, he's a historically kind of like asshole. Like, he's a character people love to hate in the series because he's just like an asshole, but they built a little bit of a backstory into him. He plays the role as a washed up action star, which you could argue that Carl Urban in his 50s making a Mortal Kombat movie, there's maybe a bit of a reality there, but he is playing it, right? Like, he has the Bruce Campbell juice of how you handle camp, and he is having fun with it. And I found that all just really, really fun. So this is not, it's not like a freaking masterpiece, you know? And even in terms of action movies, like, I'm more interested in like the Furious, that movie that's coming out like soon, very soon. But for what it is a Mortal Kombat sequel with some great choreography, really great nods to the game, a decent like acknowledgement of camp, like the Uncaged Fury stuff. It's just a lot of fun and really silly. And it also made me think of like, hey, I saw those movies. We saw those movies in the 90s. That's what movies used to be like. And this too, I wrote about this in my Engadget review. I do have a sense like this movie kind of understands what people liked about those movies, what was really bad about them, and how to try to avoid that. It feels like elevated camp, and I think that's something worth celebrating, even if it's not a perfect film.
To be clear, Uncaged Fury, right, is the name.
Yeah.
Of it. It's a fake film within the film.
It is a fake 90s action film
shot in the way
a lot of those things were, like the Steven Seagal movies where people were barely touching each other during fights. Like, it was really fake. There's a trailer for that. There's a teaser for it on YouTube, too, if you search Uncaged Fury. So you can see what we're talking about.
Jeff Cannata, so curious what you felt about Mortal Kombat 2.
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I felt about Mortal Kombat 2 is best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Well, let's hear it, Jeff.
It tries to inject personality in the game's convoluted reality. A few fights are fun, but when it's all said and done, it never quite lands its fatality.
Mm.
Listening to Devendra makes me like the movie more than I actually liked it. I want to feel how he felt about it. Mm-hmm. I think, honestly, this is a missed opportunity for you, David, to play the Dave's B Movies song,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like you should always want to play at any chance. This is a B movie through and through. I don't think the movie knows it's a B movie, which is a bummer. Like, it's, you know, the Uncaged Fury trailer in mm-hmm. it is like, look, hey, remember how B movies used to be? And then it's mm-hmm. like, you are one, man. Look in the mirror. I think some
of the fatalities they have fun with some of those things.
They do so have like, some fun. Yeah. I think the second half of this movie is much better than the first half, because the second mm-hmm. half, we just kind of get to fights, and the fights are pretty fun. Not all of them are great, in my opinion, but there are a few great ones. I particularly like, my favorite is the Liu Kang
Kung
and
Lao.
His brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fight.
Not brother, but like family. They're close.
I thought they were brothers. Aren't they brothers? Anyway.
No.
Not up on my Mortal Kombat lore.
Cousins, maybe? Yeah.
Anyway, the fight with the dude with the spinny hat and Liu Kang, very good.
We're going to talk about that in spoilers, because that is one of the funniest parts of the movie. There's an amazing part of that fight. Yeah.
Very fun fight. And there's a few other fights. Now,
my old friend, I will save you. I will save you.
The movie it's tough because it has so many characters and it's trying to do so many things. And it's pulled in all these different directions. Like, who's the main character of this movie? You could argue there's three or four main characters of this movie.
Because it starts with Katana. And that
starts with Katana. We get Johnny Cage for a while. But, like, there's a large section where he's just absent from the movie. I think the movie comes to life when Kano shows up. Who's the guy that plays Kano? He's great. Josh Lawson.
Josh Lawson is so great.
You saw the first movie, right, Jeff? Yeah. I forget if we talked about it.
Okay. Yes, I think we reviewed it. He's fantastic. And, you know, I don't have the Carl Urban love that you do, mm-hmm. Devendra. And perhaps this is unfair to say, my 9-year-old son and all his little 9-year-old friends, I'm sure you guys have heard this, their way of sort of dissing something is they'll say, oh, that's the Timu version. That's the Timu, you know, Timu Spider-Man, Timu, you know, whatever it is.
Wow.
It's amazing, like what cultural heights that phrase. Yeah,
he has reference to what even Timu is.
What is Timu, child? Yeah.
But when I was, you know, in the 80s, it was, oh, that's the Kmart version, right?
Right.
So Timu is that now. I would say, again, I'm fully aware this is unfair, but I think that Johnny Cage in this movie is Timu Wolverine from the first X-Men movie. He's like in the same outfit, white t-shirt, leather jacket. Mm-hmm. He's just doing all the beats of Hugh Jackman's Wolverine from the first Wolverine movie. He sees the crazy, wacky world. I don't want to be involved in any of that. I mean, we literally have the same scene of him at the bar, like drinking, like, hey, aren't you? No, get out of here. It's like beat for beat Wolverine from the first X-Men, and I was like, come on, can't we do something?
That's what all the kids are thinking about. Bryan Singer is 19.
What's what I'm thinking about. yeah. You know, and so I couldn't get it out of my head.
But
and
the bit, like, this opens on him at a nameless comic convention, like at the sad table. Sad table where you're waiting for signatures. You're waiting for fans to come up and nobody got, like, that hit, because we have all been in that place. And I have seen actors I quite enjoy sit there.
Yeah.
Nobody comes to them. And I have actually gone to their tables to be like, hey, man, I really liked you in this thing. Deep cut. And then I leave, like, just to throw them a bone, because it's a very sad situation.
It's a wild thing, that situation of just like sitting there like, hey, don't you love me? I'm here to just mine a little bit of that nostalgia of the love. You all love that person more than me. It's a weird thing. I didn't think the Johnny Cage character worked at all for me in the movie. Like I said, I felt like it was Timu Wolverine. It just felt like rehashing beats I've seen before. And I don't think his fights work. I didn't buy that the gods would have chosen this dude at all.
We'll talk about this in spoilers. I think the ultimate fruition of that character is kind of funny. It is kind of funny, like what he ultimately decides.
Yeah.
That first movie, by the way, we spent so much time. You got to train. Got to get your superpower. That's what people play every Mortal Kombat game. You got to know what somebody's essence power is, right? Spend 2 hours doing that. No tournament. We're not the tournament yet.
I would have been like if this movie had been more about Liu Kang, I would have been happier. I think I was much more interested in that guy. He's very much a side character for a lot, and then for sections, he's like the main. The movie,
that
like,
actor is fantastic too. The actor, he's who great. Liu Kang and the Kung Lao.
He's awesome and clearly can fight. You know,
yes.
And so this is this weird rotating
cast of characters.
Cast of characters that are all vying for main character. And so the movie feels really weird. And like so much of the first half just feels really cheesy to me and like a B movie. But it's trying really hard not to be one. And so I don't know. I like I said, hearing Devendra talk persuaded me to not be as harsh on this movie, because there were moments of fun, and I understand that it is campy and it is intentionally campy, but I do think the movie is trying to be more grounded and gritty than it achieves.
The first movie really did that. Like, and I felt like maybe is this like Marvel influencing everything? Like, not everything needs a freaking massive character backstory. Let's just where's the techno music? Where's the tournament? That's all we want.
Right,
just get us there. This movie kind of gets there without like,
It's kind of goofy how it all happens. I think the visual effects feel very like this movie looks like it was made in the 90s to me.
Yeah,
you know, and maybe that's intentional, but I didn't come away feeling like my time was well spent, frankly.
Well, as usual, I think I'm coming in a little bit between you guys. Let's talk about the stuff that I really enjoyed about the film. Right, first of all, I think the movie does a pretty good job of nailing a lot of the looks of the characters. In particular, I was very impressed with Baraka. Like, That is a character that is like looks. That is like what that character would look like in real life. You know,
it's
like,
even more horrific than the games.
It's a direct like one-to-one comparison, right?
I'm curious how much of that was digital and how much of it was just practical.
I think it was all prosthetic.
It looks very practical. I'm sure it was sweetened to some degree, perhaps.
I've seen like behind the scenes photos, and it looks like the whole thing is there. So
but I do think I'm guessing
the arm stuff. I'm sure was like more digital. But anyway, I'm saying like the face stuff. That's where it counts, and I thought that was great. And also, if you are a Mortal Kombat fan, I think this movie, like, I imagine young David Chen, who loved going to the arcades and pumping quarters into the Mortal Kombat machines, like, would have lost his mind if he watched this movie when I was, like, a teenager. Like, just the idea of, it's the thing from the game, and now it's in real life, and they're fighting. And by the way, it looks like the game. Mm-hmm. Like, there's
some shots.
Which is
what we went through in the first Mortal Kombat movie. Like,
yeah,
we do have to discuss, like, what a cultural moment that was. Because, again, not a great movie, but it did build a vibe. And the vibe was the music. The vibe was, we have not seen special effects like this before, and we've also
Paul Thomas Anderson, I think,
is the problem is that that movie did the vibe better than these two movies did.
But also, that wasn't really the vibe. It was the vibe of the 90s. That wasn't the vibe of the game, right? The games weren't like hardcore techno. It was just like, you took all these parts and made this object that is so wild and so entertaining and so much fun, and they didn't even do that again, right? Annihilation was the sequel to that movie, and like it didn't quite work. We saw what happened in the 90s. You play the music at the end of this movie. Instead, this entire movie is scored by generic sounding action score. Like, just build the vibe. Yeah, that's what people kind of want.
By the way, the score, I just want to say this, the score of the original Mortal Kombat movie was also awesome. There's a track on that movie called A Taste of Things to Come, I believe. I think it's by David Arnold. I'm not 100% sure who wrote the score for Mortal Kombat 1 original. But anyway, that score was also used in other things. Like, that's how good it was. It was, I'm pretty sure they used it in the commercial for Rumble in the Bronx. You know, like, but also, I think what Jeff is pointing to is that in many ways, the Paul W.S. Anderson Mortal Kombat film is more grounded than this one. You know,
I don't know about that.
This one is like wild and fantastical.
Because that movie is just like, forget grounding. Forget it, man. We're in the game. This movie starts with Mortal Kombat. So get to Mortal Kombat. That's all. No backstory.
I scream at you.
Yeah. I'm screaming at you to have fun.
The issue with this one is that this movie, in my opinion, there's a couple issues. Number one, its reach exceeds its grasp. It is trying to portray this massive, sprawling fantasy world. There's all these different realms, and they have this weird tournament structure where the realms can take over each other, and we're at the 10th tournament. There's been 9 previous tournaments. No idea what happened during those, but like, this is the 10th one, and you need to be ready for it. And like, in my opinion, the movie just didn't have either the budget or the time or whatever to
convince. So you want more backstory?
We
need another movie before we get to the tournament. Same with, what happened to tournaments 1-9?
Can I finish? I'm not even talking about backstory, Devendra, okay? I'm talking about, can you visually convince me that these are people actually in these places? It often looks like green screen or volume or whatever in a way that feels very unconvincing to me. And that is because I think this movie is much more ambitious than the first film. Like, the first film, the one that the 2021 one, right? Directed by the same guy. Most of the fights took place in recognizably Earthbound locations.
Written by somebody else entirely, by the way. So this one's written by Jeremy Lee Slater. That first movie, it felt like that was written by a fan. Like, this is my Mortal Kombat fan film, the origin of Scorpion.
Right.
Origin of Sub-Zero. How did we get here, man? And
it is crazy that this movie basically has no Sub-Zero and no Scorpion. I mean, not completely, but
let's talk in spoilers about where that goes. But I think the Jeremy Slater, I believe, gave an interview to IO9 where he described a lot of the approach to this as the Key and Peele Gremlins 2 sketch.
Yeah.
Where people are naming things like, should that go? What if it was a, what if there's a hot gremlin? What if there's a gremlin that uses electric powers? And then there's a guy in the executive room that's like, it's in the movie. It's in the movie. It's in the movie. Like there's everything is in the movie. And that's the case. And literally this is the comparison they use. This is not me. They said it's like the Gremlins 2 movie where we just threw everything in the movie. And I think that makes for a movie that Mortal Kombat fans of the video game are going to have a blast watching, and virtually no one else, in my opinion. You know, like I just think that most people who aren't fans of the video game or the first film, there's not going to be that much to hold on to here, because I think a lot of it's going to be total nonsense. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I would say at the very least, fans of action movies, the choreography is good. I've seen a lot of bad choreography in my life, and this movie does the things like you give me complex, really interesting moves. You give me time where the camera pulls back and just lets people fight in a wide shot, too, that is evocative of the games. Like, it does enough to be like, oh, I enjoy these fight scenes, you know?
Yeah, I will say there's a handful of fight scenes that are very good. And Jeff mentioned the Liu Kang Kung Lao fight scene. They are cousins, by the way. That was like probably one of the better fights.
The magician's first cousin. I'm
told. Yeah, nice show.
My problem with that though is that I fairly recently saw Blades of the Guardians, which have you guys seen that yet?
Yeah. No, I saw.
You guys have to see that movie.
Yeah,
like it has ruined me for fight scenes in 2026. Because like you, Devendra, I'm excited for. What's it called?
The Furious.
I'm very excited for that movie. But
yes,
there's nothing in Mortal Kombat 2 that even
you know what's funny
approaches Blades of the Guardians.
Yeah. Blades of the Guardians stars has Jet Li in it, directed by Yuen Wu Ping. I thought it was perfectly fine. You know, like it has some great fight.
You didn't
scenes.
Love it?
I did not.
I thought it was made for you. It was fine
because I've seen a lot of those types of movies. The fight scenes were okay. Like they're pretty good.
Would you put Mortal Kombat 2's fight scenes above Blades of the Guardians fight scenes?
You know what? I've seen a lot of fight scenes of people fighting in the desert. Like a lot of those things. The choreography is totally fine. That's also a B movie.
I'm loving Jeff's reaction to this right now.
It's very much a B movie. The only thing is it's not in English, so you can't quite see how much of a B movie it is.
Oh, it's definitely a B movie, but I'm just saying the fight scenes are on a completely different level, in my opinion. I am shocked that you don't.
Some of them. Again, but
I gotta watch this movie, Jeff, to
Mortal Kombat movie.
I have to now, yeah.
There's no spinning blade hats in that movie. There's a lot of things. There's a big
weapons
difference.
Catch on fire, David. I mean, DaVinci.
Yeah. I've seen weapons catch on fire all the time.
All right.
It's fine.
We gotta get the spoilers. But Devendra loved Mortal Kombat 2. Jeff, not a fan.
Wait,
I think it's great if you're a fan of the games. You will find stuff to enjoy here. You know.
I want to say one more thing before we go to spoilers, and that is the other thing that I think is a problem here is that. The last few actual Mortal Kombat games have had really decent story modes.
Yeah, I've heard.
And the visuals are almost photorealistic. The visuals in the games look like people with makeup on and wearing costumes. And so, like, at this point, I kind of feel like this movie is a little redundant in that you get it just playing the game, you kind of get a better experience story-wise, and...
Do you know what I don't like, Jeff? I don't like playing Mortal Kombat. I'm a Street Fighter man. Sorry.
I do prefer Street Fighter as well, but I'd rather do the fighting than watch the fighting. But
there are a whole bunch of animated movies, too, which people have pointed us to, and I'm aware those exist. Again, I want to... the vibe of the 90s movie, that is what I want. Get us back there. We as a society have gone on a downward trajectory since that movie. So come on, bring it back.
Let's get the spoilers for Mortal Kombat 2 starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth.
Inconceivable.
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
Here's one thing I admire about Mortal Kombat 2 is making an entire movie to set up a brand new protagonist that's not in the video games at all. We're like, we're going to create a whole cloth new character. And just in the second film being like, oh, wow, people didn't like that? fuck him. Like, he's just
head smash.
He's gonna be in literally 3 minutes of this film, and we're gonna smash his head in. You know?
Imagine Louis Tan reading the script like, "Hey guys, Cole Young's just not."
Did you send over the Cole Young pages in the script? I didn't get those.
My script's kind of light. I don't know what's going on.
I've been waiting years for me to finally be in the tournament. What?
He was in the tournament, and he's still there because his brains are on the floor.
Also, you know,
but just to, before we finish that point, it's just like they really did recalibrate after the first film, right? And like for good or ill, in my opinion, here's the problem. In my opinion, and a lot of people have given me shit about this, I think the first film is good. Like, Mortal Kombat 1, the Simon McCoy movie, is a movie I would feel comfortable showing to non-Mortal Kombat fans. Like, hey, this movie gives you a sense of why I like Mortal Kombat. I'd feel comfortable recommending Mortal Kombat 1, the movie, to basically anyone. Because it's a normal movie. It's like a conventional film that has a protagonist and a three-act
structure. Conventional is the word to use. It is Mortal Kombat. Shave off all those rough edges.
Let me finish the point. Okay. Mortal Kombat 2, not a movie I feel comfortable recommending to anyone, right?
Like, good.
This is a movie.
Not everything has to be for everybody.
This is a movie that it's like, yeah, this is only for the hardcore fans because I think only they will appreciate it. I don't know what people who don't have any affiliation with Mortal Kombat would do with this movie. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the craziest thing about this is if someone has heard of Mortal Kombat, they have heard of Scorpion, Sub-Zero, and Raiden. Those are the characters who are almost completely absent from
this. And Johnny Cage.
You want your fill of Scorpion and Sub-Zero? That's all the first movie. That's all.
I know.
Let's learn about their backstory. Let's learn about their beef. Let's learn about origins of their devil power, like hell powers, like all that stuff. And my thing about that first movie is like, guys, can we move on? Like, okay, I know how to set up a story. Why are we spending an hour for people to discover their powers? What is going on here?
I have to say this to you. I know it's very clear we disagree about this film.
Yeah.
But say what you will about the first film. I felt more in that first 6 to 7 minutes of Mortal Kombat 1 when Scorpion's family is assassinated by Sub-Zero.
That's the best scene of the movie.
But this movie never even rises to that level for me. Like, nothing in Mortal Kombat 2 rises to the level of the opening scene.
It tries to do the
scene.
Exact same thing at the beginning.
Yeah.
It tries to do the same thing with Katana.
Right, it tries to do the
right,
Katana.
Right. Yeah. But,
and again,
which, by the way, is not bad. That opening scene is not bad.
It's not a bad scene. It's a good scene.
It's like a solid opening scene. But you know, you're going up against Hiroyuki Sanada, right? And like, that's just a tough thing to
do. It's tough. So, I mean, but also, again, I've seen many samurai scene movies where
that's the opening scene. Brutally killed. Right,
yeah. Yes, you take this thing that you have seen many times before. Did you know that's Scorpion? Did you know that Scorpion? And also Scorpion, master tactician in battle. Your family's getting murdered like 100 feet away from you. You're not hearing anything, buddy. I rewatched that movie.
We're relitigating the first Mortal Kombat movie.
Apparently we are. But I'm just saying.
All right. So,
I hear you. I know why you like it. I get it.
Yeah.
It's very conventional.
You're right. Yeah. It's a conventional film. And it's like, oh, this is like a decent movie version of the thing. This
How
is
does
like,
Marvel get everybody to love superheroes?
Right.
They made a palatable entry point for a lot
of
people.
This movie is for the real sickos who like are really into the game. And I think they will find a lot to enjoy here, you know?
This movie is for people who will cackle when Liu Kang says to the evil, zombified version of Kung Lao, "I will save you. I will find a way to save you." Then 10 seconds later, splits his head open.
Just not right now. I will save you, but not in the future.
But apparently, like, death doesn't mean anything in this universe.
There's
anyways,
a necromancer. So, yeah, Ko Young's going to be back. Whatever. Like, I was shocked when they, like, smashed his brains in. That is kind of funny that you did that to the lead of the first movie. Yeah.
I still can't get over the fact that you think that the fight scenes in this movie are universally excellent. I think there are some good fight scenes, but I do not think that.
I judge movies in their entirety, in their full entirety, right? And the Yun Wu-Ping movie, the fight scenes are great.
Incredible. Yeah,
I did not care. I did not give a fuck about any of those characters.
I did not care
about those
characters. I don't give a fuck about any of these characters.
Yeah, I'm shocked.
I just spent 2 hours of setup. getting to know a lot of them. So
I haven't seen Blades of the Guardians, and even I'm offended. I need to watch it so I can be re-offended.
Yuen Woo Ping has made a lot of bad movies. By have you forgotten here. Crouching Tiger 2? Yuen Woo Ping directed that. He's directed, like, as much as I love him and he's a master, not all of his movies are hits.
There are a couple of decent fight scenes in this one, right? Like, Katana fight scene against Johnny Cage, pretty decent. Kung Lao Liu Kang, very good. Like, that was really creative. Like, when he throws the hat and then teleports into the hat, right? Very good. Yep. Like, all that stuff.
I thought the end where we're, like, cutting between multiple fights that are all concurrent, I thought that was done really well. I will give it credit. But I do think the second half of this movie is much better than the first half. I thought the first half, it took so long to sort of get going. And the fights at the beginning, I did not think were very good. I didn't love, I was really worried, honestly, when the movie started. Like, that first fight with Katana's dad, I just didn't think it was very good. And then there was a couple of other fights. And I was like, ugh. And then they get better and better. So, you know, it ends... It saves its best stuff for last, which I always appreciate in a movie.
They kind of learned the lesson from the first movie. Like, the first movie, the opening fights are the best. Unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Any other thoughts about Mortal Kombat 2? And by the way, like, I guess we should just talk about how we feel this movie leaves Mortal Kombat. Like, Mortal Kombat 3 has already been greenlit, right? How do we feel about where we...
It tries to end on a cliffhangery thing.
So
is it a cliffhanger?
I mean, not cliffhanger,
like,
but
the band
like
is together. We're gonna
we're walking we're off. Now we're gonna do the next thing
without Cole Young. By the way,
Cole Young.
Fuck that guy.
He'll be back. We got
his
a necromancer.
Hey,
we got this guy here. This guy seems important. This necromancer. Yeah.
So here's what happens at the end of the movie, according to Wikipedia. Right, Shang Tsung attempts to kill Raiden in his weakened state, but the amulet's destruction restores the latter's power and easily repels his attack. Sometime later, Johnny, Sonya, Raiden, Katana, Jade, Kano, and Baraka prepare to use a captured Quan Chi to revive the other fallen champions, end quote.
There you go. By the way, Quan Chi is played by Damon Harriman.
That's wild.
I know. It's wild. Yeah. Like, the dude shaves his head. He's, like, in full makeup, just being goofy. Like, that dude is usually
He looks
like
one of the
Oscar
villains
movies.
From Lord of the Rings. Yeah, yeah.
Very
strange.
So, Devendra, are you looking forward to the third? What does Devendra Hardware want to see in the third Mortal Kombat?
This movie is specifically made for me. When I saw that trailer, I was like, you're putting Carl Urban, 50-something Carl Urban, who has never headlined a Hollywood picture. He is, well, Dredd. He did Dredd, but we didn't see his face. Nobody knew that was Carl Urban.
Amazing movie, by the way.
And he's Johnny Cage? The more I learned about this movie, the more it felt like it was made for me. Like, as somebody, like, I am not making up my fandom for Carl Urban here. I think he is a genre actor who's always delivered, who's always fun. In Hercules and Xena, he was multiple characters, I believe. He was Julius Caesar at one point. Like, I've just always enjoyed watching him. I think he has a lot of, like, innate charisma, and he's an actor that I've always wanted more for. So now it's like, hey, get to see him be in a very successful Mortal Kombat sequel. I love that for him. And I like the movie. I don't have high expectations for this. You know, like, it met my expectations of what I imagine a Mortal Kombat movie should be. And I think, like, personally, I still think it feels like the best Mortal Kombat movie to me. Like, I have to make less excuses for this one than the first one. But the first one was a better vibe, and is wild how we had this perfect vibe and they keep missing. They do not understand how to recreate that. Maybe it was just the 90s. You had to have techno. It was the 90s. You can't recreate that. Yeah.
That very first 90s movie just felt like a celebration of this thing. It was isn't this crazy? We got to make this, you know? And
the
now
music
we're
is
this...
better than you've ever heard before, like in a Hollywood movie. Like, that was, you had to grow up in the 90s to understand the rise of techno, because, like, whatever electronic music is today, it is not the same. And I was there. I was there for all of it. It was so
good. I had literally CDs that I bought from the store that were just like collections of rave music.
Yes. Yes. Mm.
Go speed. Go speed. You know, the Speed Racer rave song. So good. Anyway, I do think this is the first movie where someone gets punched in the balls and then thanks the person for doing it.
The Johnny Cage Baraka stuff. I'm sorry. That sold me. Like, your power is, you are Johnny Cage. And the Baraka stuff is just, it was funny.
I did enjoy that. I thought that was fairly enjoyable. But by the way, I made a mistake. It's George S. Clinton that did the score for Mortal Kombat 1 and the Paul W. Sanderson one. And I thought he did a marvelous job. So anyway, that is our thoughts on Mortal Kombat 2. A good time was had by some.
And we'll be back for Mortal Kombat 3, which is the thing that's happening.
I think, I'll just say this. I think what's so interesting is Mortal Kombat 2 had such a different structure than Mortal Kombat 1.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, are they just going to do the same thing again for Mortal Kombat? Is it just going to be a whole bunch of different characters, no main character for Mortal Kombat 3? You know, like, I hope that they pick a main character and stick with it this time. Like, that's what I'm going to say. Like, say you can have, like, 50 fights, that's all these characters, that's cool, but, like, have a main character next time. And I think that will be a better experience for everyone. That's my hope. But despite everything I just said, at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Simon McCoy made a movie. And that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of The Filmcast. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. Check out their new album, Syndicate. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode, with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast is going to be Obsession. It's going to be our main review. I've heard, I mean, this was the thing that BJ Colangelo and German Lucier were like, you got to watch this. This is the movie of the summer. I will say here in Portugal, they're treating it in a really, like they're giving it like the biggest theaters here. You know, like it's like, they're treating it like a big event, I think. And by the way, the movie title here is not Obsession. It's Obsession, A Felicidade Relativa, which means happiness is relative. So Obsession, happiness is relative. I'm curious what that's going to mean. You know, is that going to mean anything, or is that just complete? Anyway, regardless, next week's movie is Obsession. Stay tuned later this week for Davinder and I's interview with Simon McCoy, director of Mortal Kombat 2. Until then, we'll see you later. Goodbye.